From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, one of the nation's oldest community media outlets marks its 40th anniversary, Flint's East Village Magazine.
We are hyper-local, trying to get the news out and also to do it with some flair, with really good writing, really good journalism, really good photography.
Helping immigrant and refugee children settle into Michigan schools.
We focus on inclusion and we work with educators to think about how the whole community can play a part in, again, creating that welcoming school environment.
Searching the Upper Peninsula woods for Bigfoot.
I look at Bigfoot as it's a flesh and blood creature that has evolved right alongside of us. They know how dangerous we are, so they've become really good at avoiding us.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As tensions between police and minority communities continue to roil our nation, one Michigan sheriff, Jerry Clayton of Washtenaw County, is implementing some fundamental changes.
Improved quality of life, a stronger relationship, a focus on solutions as opposed to blame. That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that that we see each other in a slightly different light as human beings, that understand we have to work together toward a common goal for us to experience the kind of quality of life we all want.
But first, Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson has declared he intends to file suit to stop resettlement of Syrian refugees in his county. At the same time, Donald Trump Jr. is being slammed for comparing refugees to Skittles. He tweeted, "Even if just a few can hurt you, you shouldn't take a handful." Amidst this climate, the refugees who've just arrived in Michigan are focused on getting jobs, learning English, and rebuilding their lives. For some, that starts at an English/job training class in Sterling Heights. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reports.
You have just arrived in Michigan, you barely speak any English, and you now find yourself in this windowless classroom with a lot of fluorescent lights and a chipper English teacher, practicing an imaginary scenario where you meet a factory co-worker named Tony Menendez.
Are you Tony Menendez?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Tony. Nice to meet you. I am Raf Sabson.
Good to meet you.
Sabson.
Raf.
Fantastic. Yeah. All of your reading is very good. You just need more confidence, okay? Tell yourself, I can do this, because you can.
There's at least one refugee in this class who has already got that kind of confidence. In fact, this whole beginner level thing is driving him a little bit nuts.
I want to use my brain.
This is Nemet Al-Shamyani. He is a civil engineer from Baghdad. He does not like talking about life before in Iraq.
Because it is in the past.
He and his three kids, he says, spent about 7 years slowly making their way through the refugee application process.
Yes, it took about 7 years to complete my documents and coming here.
And when he finally got here 4 months ago, he says everything was really confusing.
Because the people are very different, the streets, the buildings, and the procedures.
But if there's one thing about Al-Shamyani, it's that he is a fast learner, and he is clearly desperate to get back to some real work. Like at one point in this class, another refugee can't understand something the teacher is saying about machinists. So Al-Shamyani launches into this long, detailed explanation in Arabic, way more detailed than this student would ever need. He's even using props.
Like, I don't want to say he doesn't belong there, but he definitely knows much more than everyone else who never worked in the industry.
This is Vesna Sismic. She's with Samaritas, which is the refugee resettlement agency that's offering these classes.
You know, like, we can definitely try to find him a job.
But of course, it can be more complicated to find work for really highly qualified refugees like Al-Shamyani. Because right now, Sismic says there's plenty of jobs for refugees in entry-level stuff, like hotel housekeeping, McDonald's, working the 4 a.m. shift at a plant. For Al-Shamyani, he says, yeah, sometimes he gets anxious about getting a job in his field.
It may take time, but not more long time. It may take a few months to get this job. And at that time, I would be happy more than now. I'm happy now, but if I can find the job, because without a job, I cannot find myself.
His kids, meanwhile, they are doing really good, he says. All three of them are in school, and his youngest, Miriam, she wants to be a pharmacist. In fact, she's taking this class right next to him. And when he talks about Miriam, he smiles for the first time in this afternoon. How is Miriam adjusting to the U.S., I ask.
Yes, she looked like happy. Because she moved to another country, so a different country. You mean that, you know, like we cannot get our freedom. And yes,
yeah.
Something happened. Something happy happened to her.
Getting here, getting to the U.S. after 7 years of trying, that is something happy. Al-Shamiani and his family, of course, have only been here for 4 months. They do not know what is going to come next. But they're here, they're learning, and at least for today, that is enough. For Stateside, I'm Kate Wells.
As Michigan kids get settled into their classrooms in this new school year, there is a group that can use some extra support, the children who are immigrants or refugees. Christina Sove works for Welcoming Michigan. It's part of the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. Christina, tell us more. Just what is Welcoming Michigan?
We are an immigrant integration project of the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, and we work with local communities across the state to help build more immigrant-friendly and inclusive environments.
And I know you're using kind of an interesting new approach. You're focusing efforts more on what U.S.-born Americans are thinking and feeling about immigrants coming in?
Yeah, we're looking at what U.S.-born residents can do to play a part in that welcoming process. So it's incredibly important to work directly with immigrants and refugees, but we also say in order to make our communities feel more welcoming for everyone, we all play a part in that. So thinking about what each of us, regardless of our background or heritage, what can we do to help new neighbors feel welcomed and included in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, and in our school environments?
And overall, what kind of fears and concerns do you get from the U.S.-born Americans about immigrants coming in? What do you address and how do you do it?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety that comes up, especially around different election seasons. So political rhetoric can sometimes heighten fears of U.S.-born residents. So, you know, there's concerns that folks won't be able to adjust to the American lifestyle or won't fit in. And we counter that with great examples of how new neighbors are doing just that. And we also like to remind folks of our ancestors who came before. I know my great-grandfather came from Sicily, and he had a difficult time learning English and really relied on my grandfather to help him navigate the community, because my grandfather, as a child of an immigrant, he spoke English, and he learned and adapted and learned the language very quickly.
So it's a story that we've seen repeating from the time this country began. So let's talk about these children who are coming into school right now as immigrants and refugees. What are you doing to help and support them?
So this is a great time to be talking about this at the beginning of the school year. So students who are either recently arrived or came a couple years ago in the school environment, that's such an important place to focus on inclusion and making sure that all students feel supported in their education. So we focus on inclusion, and we work with educators to think about how the whole community can play a part in, again, creating that welcoming school environment. And it's important because it can help students' confidence and their self-esteem and their academic achievement, and then that leads, of course, to better attendance and parent involvement. There's lots of examples out there that we highlight that schools can replicate.
Yeah, give us some ideas. I would love to hear some strategies or programs that you've seen that really have worked to make these immigrant students feel part of the family and destigmatize the difference.
Yeah, so engaging students, first and foremost, is one of the ways to start. And so that means not just supporting the English language learning teachers, the ELL teachers, and the incredible work that they do, but also engaging the U.S.-born students in the classroom to become part of that welcoming process. So there's examples of after-school groups or international clubs to set that tone, pairing students in the classroom as buddies for new students. Labeling different parts of the classroom in multiple languages helps the new students learn the language for different items. Inviting all the students in the classroom to share about their heritage and their culture through assignments. you know, really utilizing the backgrounds and stories of immigrant and refugee students as a benefit for the learning process for all students. So having students share their family history and their story or their culture, and really uplifting how we each have a unique story, and there's some similarities and differences, but that's an important part of creating that environment that's supportive for new students. There's a very cool program called the Seal of Biliteracy, and two school districts in Michigan have adopted this, so the Dearborn Public Schools and Utica Community Schools. And what this does is create a pathway from kindergarten all the way through high school with different levels of attainment that show you've achieved certain markers in learning a foreign language. And then when you graduate, you can have an additional seal on your diploma that shows you're proficient in this language and have achieved this level. And what's great about that is that it highlights speaking another language as an asset. So it's not seen as a burden in the classroom or as something to be ashamed of. It's truly something that we all want to aspire to. And ideally, speaking another language will help students succeed after school and, you know, in going to college or in the workplace. So that's a program that really is beneficial for all students. And it's really exciting to see the two school districts in Michigan leading in that.
You can learn more about Welcoming Michigan by going to michiganimmigrant.org, and you can find the Welcoming Michigan link there. And we've been talking with Christine Sove of Welcoming Michigan. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Christine.
Thanks, Cindy. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This year marks the 40th anniversary of East Village Magazine, the little magazine that could. This nonprofit magazine has been bringing community news to people in Flint since 1976, a labor of love for its founder, the late Gary Custer. East Village Magazine has hung in there to become one of the nation's oldest community media outlets. Here with us now is Jan Worth Nelson, who's editor of East Village Magazine. Jan, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Good to have you here. And we have Nick Custer, the managing editor. And if that name sounds familiar, yes, he is the nephew of founder Gary Custer. Welcome.
Thank you. Real pleasure.
Jan, how would you describe East Village Magazine to someone who's never seen it or read it?
It's very local, hyper-local, but it also has always had consciously a set, sort of a sense of style. We try to have very good writing in it. We try to do some literary things, personal essays, and you notice the beautiful covers. We're known for our covers. Nick's father, Ed, is our photographer, has been for 40 years.
And not many pages. So the idea is, rather than some big, thick thing stuffed with advertising, you're bringing writing.
Yeah, right. We really care about the written word. That really matters to us. I was a writing teacher at U of M Flint for 25 years, and I really, really, and I have an MFA in creative writing, so, and, you know, a background in journalism. So to me, the survival of the written word in a quality format is really, really important to me. But I wanted to mention that the photography part is also central to who we are, that Gary was a photojournalism major at the University of Missouri, and he brought that journalism commitment to East Village Magazine for 40 years.
Well, Nick, tell us more about your uncle, Gary, and how did he come to found this magazine 40 years ago?
Well, it's a really interesting
story. We should mention, by the way, you were certainly not around.
Yeah, no, definitely not. But I grew up alongside the magazine, and it's been a really interesting experience. So he started it back in 1976 after coming back from, I believe, reporting in the Navy during Vietnam and doing a couple other things in Flint in the intervening years. And I think a lot of the impetus came from kind of this need for the community to have a voice and to have some more control of what was going on. The kind of central neighborhood that where he lived and a lot of the activities have taken place was part of the urban renewal. So about half the neighborhood was turned into Interstate 475. At the time, my understanding is a lot of the residents were very much against this, and it was kind of done from a top-down perspective. And so this was a way to regain control, to allow people locally to have these kind of AP journalism skills, which are very important, and to really just give Flint another outlet to speak its mind and to share information.
And Jan, when and how did you first encounter this magazine?
When I first encountered it was when I came to Flint as a social worker in 1981. I had an MSW from Michigan, and I got a job in Flint, and I got a little walk-up apartment on Avon Street. There was this little, as I have described, there's this little black and white thing that came to my door occasionally, and I had no idea what it was. I had a background in journalism, but I was there in Flint for social work. So then I found out that the Custer family, this was a labor of love of the Custer family and had been going for 6 years or so by the time I came to Flint. And I eventually got to know Gary. So he was already legendary when I came to Flint and when I discovered this magazine.
And you now you're its editor.
Right.
What do you feel is the mission statement?
Well, we're there to inform the community about local matters that maybe they wouldn't find out from anyone else. We're very committed to some things that might seem to be wonky, but that really affect people's lives, like what happens in the zoning boards and planning commissions sometimes. So we're there for the neighborhood. We're there to get news out for the neighborhood. Our overriding umbrella is called the Village Information Center. So we are hyper-local, trying to get the news out, and also to do it with some flair, with really good writing, really good journalism, really good photography.
Nick, give us a sense of some of the topics that have been covered in recent issues.
Well, most recently, in the issue that just came out last month, I did a large piece about the mayor's plan for the infrastructure replacement in the city of Flint and got a state kind of perspective on how realistic that funding is and what still kind of, isn't on the table. We've done stuff from all sorts of perspectives on great community nonprofits exist and are doing work out there against school board matters, things from city council all the way down to neighborhood associations. We find that often, or at least I find, often some of the most functional organizations are actually at the neighborhood level and not in city governments.
Right there at the grassroots.
So it's just a really important perspective, and you hear news and information that honestly you can't get anywhere else.
And the idea that it's coming out to people in Flint whose lives are directly impacted, this, how do you get this out to people? I mean, you came home and found this little magazine at your doorstep.
Right,
how are you distributing this?
That's, I think, the most fascinating part of it all, and maybe why it's only 8 to 12 pages at a month. It's all volunteer. So we have neighbors. They decide, I care about this. I want the information to get out there. I'll volunteer to do my block or my entire neighborhood. And that's really both a great advantage and slight disadvantage. You only can reach as many people as are willing to distribute. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, people that are really committed. And we really do feel like a large family, like a real community that's making a difference in Flint.
Well, you do say heavily volunteer. I take it as they're being dropped off on people's mailboxes and doorsteps. Yeah. People aren't paying for this, so how do you keep the business going?
Well, we have advertising. We have some advertisers that I think there's two or three advertisers who've been with us for the whole 40 years. Mm. So, for instance, the Temple Dining Room is one of my favorite ones. It's a downtown institution at the Masonic Temple. So we have advertising. We make a pitch for donations, so our upcoming birthday party is a fundraiser. Mm.
Oh, and occasionally we get blessed with some grants. And so this run, we've been really lucky to have support from the C.S. Ma Foundation, which is also the organization that gave the first seed grant to start East Village 40 years ago.
So it's perfect. We're talking with Jan Worth Nelson and Nick Custer of East Village Magazine in Flint. It's really one of the nation's oldest community media outlets. What does community journalism mean to you, Nick?
I think community journalism is really being able to look at issues with a sense of empathy, with a sense of understanding and context that often you can't get when you have large media outlets coming into the community and just doing a quick overview. The water crisis is a great example.
And I certainly want us to talk about that.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How did that community journalism approach inform the way you covered the Flint water crisis, Jan?
Well, because we're really deeply rooted in the community, we were experiencing it every day along with our readers. We're all the same neighbors. We all live next door to each other. So you're
brushing your teeth with a bottled water and
absolutely.
Worrying about water filters.
Yes.
Yeah. So I wrote this back page column for EVM. I've been doing that for about 10 years or so. So I found myself responding personally to it, which was something that I could do with the format that we have. And that was very helpful to me, and I think it was a way to go beyond the shows and the hearings and the struggles of picking up water and everything. There was a personal voice that was able to be expressed in the magazine that wasn't seen in the same way anywhere else, I don't think. Also, Nick did some fabulous reporting. He wrote a story just about how to figure out if you're lead, if you had lead service lines coming into your house. And we had a little diagram that showed people how to do it.
Right.
And they didn't get that kind of help anywhere else. So we got like thousands of hits on that one article that was online and then appeared in the magazine itself. That's been a kind of coverage that I think is useful because we're coming at it from we live here and this
Absolutely.
Is what other people are saying.
Well, unlike most of the journalists who came in from around the world and focused on Flint, and that had to have been odd at the very least to see your town become the, you know, in the white hot spotlight of world attention.
Yeah, in a few ways, it was validating that the work we're doing is good and important and empowering of residents, especially stuff where we're able to give them the tools to make those decisions for themselves. At the same time, you know, it was also a little scary in ways because people will come in and they'll get it wrong consistently. And it's not necessarily their fault so much as it's such a complicated issue. And if you don't really have a local focus or a bit of context to understand what's really going on, you get lost in all the details. And so a lot of people will say, oh, it was Flint's officials that made this decision or it was solved now and it's this, this, this. And the reality is, you know, we're still dealing with the problems. And on the ground, it looks a lot different than the perceptions you get reading the articles.
Right.
So 40 years under your belt. What are your long-range goals for EVM?
Well, we want to keep it going. We always have these debates. So it's good that you would ask this question, I guess. And I don't have a quick answer. You know, we're kind of retro. We're it's a pickup magazine. It's not subscription. We're doing it as a nonprofit. We're depending on 50 distributors in rain and snow.
Volunteers. Family involvement.
Yes. And now there are like our family has expanded. I would like to keep it going because I think Flint is just a fascinating place to be. And its story needs to be told at the level that we're able to tell it. And since none of us are like paid, we can be honest in a way that is very freeing and liberating. And I think that our city deserves to have that kind of attention by people who live there. And then I'm just crazy about the aesthetics of it too.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. And I inherited the aesthetics from Gary. And Ed, Nick's very artistic father, who was also a city planner in Flint for many years. And I just love it. And so I would love to keep that going as a gift to the community. That's where I've spent my whole adult life.
And is that something I'm going to look at the next generation? Because you're the one that would if take this into the future. Do you see this happening? Is this sustainable?
Sustainability is such a funny term, right?
It is.
You know, I'm along for the ride, and I have been for the last 12 years since I was 16 years old when I first started writing. I love the kind of stuff you can get out of East Village Magazine, the networks, the information you find that otherwise you wouldn't even ever know, and just the idea that what we're creating is something that doesn't exist in Flint. One of the main focuses of the magazine is education. We teach people these styles. There's not currently journalism programs at all in the Flint area.
Right.
And so if you want to learn these skills, you either have to work for us or you might have to leave. And so we're giving people another reason to stay and love their community.
You can find the magazine at its website, eastvillagemagazine.org. There'll also be a 40th anniversary celebration happening this Saturday, September 24th, at the Flint Farmers Market. It runs from 4 to 9 p.m. I've been speaking with Jan Worth Nelson, the editor of East Village Magazine, and Nick Custer, the managing editor and the nephew of founder Gary Custer. Thanks to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cynthia.
A recent photo from Michigan flew around the internet, a trail cam photo. It showed the rear end of a big dark furred something or another. Some believe that big critter was a Bigfoot, until a second photo from the same trail cam showed it was a bear. But that is not deterring the ongoing quest to find and photograph a Bigfoot, or if you will, Sasquatch. Rich Mayers with the Upper Peninsula Bigfoot Sasquatch Research Organization. Rich, your group's Facebook page says you're all about Bigfoot research and counseling without ridicule, and you're a no-kill, no-harm organization. So you're just trying to prove the existence of Bigfoot?
Correct. We're using the scientific method, getting different types of evidence and proving the existence without having a body.
So when you say using the scientific method, in what ways are you trying to prove the existence?
Just like when they went out and looked for the silverback gorillas and they had footprints, then they found different evidence, scat, different types of rocks used as tools, things like that. We're doing the same thing. We're out looking for footprints. We're looking for tree breaks. we're recording audio of different howls, things that don't quite fit where they should be.
And what got you into this, Rich?
What got me into this is I was honestly watching Finding Bigfoot one night, and then I was on the phone with my mother. My father had passed away about a year before this. She said, well, you know, that's part of the reason your dad had had you in the woods all the time, is he knew there was something else there, but didn't know how to find it or explain it, so he was always looking. So I grew up in the woods. I was hunting, fishing, having a good time with my dad, all while he was looking for Bigfoot and not telling anybody.
Ah, so it's really in your blood.
Correct.
How many possible Bigfoot sightings are you personally aware of, Rich?
Possible sightings that I'm aware of, well, I'm also an investigator for the BFRO, which is the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization that's been in existence since 1995. Through them, I know that I have at least 13 ongoing investigations, plus the ones that come into my Facebook page, which is the Upper Peninsula Bigfoot Sasquatch Research Organization.
So when you say 13 ongoing investigations, somebody sees a track or thinks they see something, report that, and then that's when you begin to do the research.
Right. These are reports of either tracks, or I had these howls in the middle of the night. I was out on the edge of my yard, and there were rocks being thrown at me. And there's people that have things as small as a howl to, I had one run across the road in front of me.
People who have reported that. Have you ever had a moment where you have actually laid eyes on something where you went, whoa, that could be it?
I have had a lot of experiences that have built up over the years that have made me do it. But as far as actually seeing a clear picture or myself standing there and seeing something that's 100% Bigfoot, I have not. I have seen in Wisconsin, I've seen the phenomenon they call iGlow, where we were standing on one side of a field looking across it, and I saw what looked like it would have been about the brightness of two LED lights separated about where you would expect the eyes to be, that came on and then off like a blink, and then on and then off. I can't say 100% they were eyes, but that's what it felt like looking at them.
Hmm.
I've also found tracks. I've found trees where the branches are broken, twisted around, and then pointed up the tree, which defies gravity and everything else that we know.
If a Bigfoot was ever to be caught, what would that mean to you?
What would it mean to me? It would mean that all of this time that myself and other researchers have been spending in the woods and looking, it would mean, hey, you guys aren't as crazy as everybody has said in the past.
And I notice, as your group's Facebook says, it's about Bigfoot research and counseling without ridicule. So I take it you probably have had to have a fair amount of, you know, people snickering over a beer or something when they find out it's what you do.
I've had people snicker over that. My wife is a 100% non-believer, but my stepdaughter is in the woods with me as often as she can be. She kind of leans both ways, and like I told her, I said, whether you believe in Bigfoot or not, I've got you out in the woods. You're learning different things because I'm teaching her different animal tracks and different signs and what to watch out for as far as when she's walking down a trail, if there's a dead tree that hangs over it, how to go around it or be safe around it.
You're passing along things your dad passed to you.
I am.
Now, I know you're getting ready to lead a weekend expedition in the Upper Peninsula for the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, and my understanding is this is open to everyone?
Yes, it is a public expedition. All people need to do to sign up is go onto the BFRO's website, which is bfro.net. Down about three quarters of the way on the page, there is a link that will take you to all the open expeditions because they're actually going on throughout the country. They go on year-round.
And I know it's October 20th to the 23rd. I can't think of a more beautiful place to be in October than going through the Upper Peninsula woods.
Yep, and the place we're going, we've had great success in the past. We've had people that have had a Class A sighting, which is they've physically seen the animal or the creature, however you want to talk about it. We've recorded wood knocks, we've recorded rock clacks, we've recorded howls, screams, we've found footprints in cast, and we've found full trackways. So it's definitely a hot spot where we're going.
Rich, when you think of Bigfoot, in your mind, what is Bigfoot?
To me, I look at Bigfoot because there's so many different ways of looking at Bigfoot. I look at Bigfoot as it's a flesh and blood creature that has evolved right alongside of us. So they know how dangerous we are. So they've become really good at avoiding us.
Well, you can find the Upper Peninsula Bigfoot Sasquatch Research Organization just right there on Facebook. Lots more information. Rich Mayer, thank you so much for sharing your passion with us, and good luck with the hunt.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Art Prize opens today in Grand Rapids. Among the 1,453 artist entries for this year's competition is a play to be performed each evening by Adapt Theater Company of Grand Rapids. The play is Stories in Blue, a pilgrimage to heal human trafficking. It's theater, it's an art piece, and a social justice campaign. With us is the playwright. She's the assistant artistic director of ADAPT and an assistant professor of theater, dance, and film studies at Washington and Lee University. Stephanie Sandberg, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What led you to say, you know what I want to do for Art Prize? I want to explore human trafficking in West Michigan.
Well, you know, I was at a social justice concert, I think it was a couple years ago, and somebody came up to me and said, hey, you know, you work on these issues. Did you know that at the time, Michigan was number two in the country for human trafficking? And they said, did you know that this is going on? And I said, well, I knew that this was a major issue in the world and in America, but I didn't know where we stood. And then I started to work with some agencies, especially Women at Risk in Grand Rapids, and found out so much more. And then I started to talk to survivors, and I realized that we had something that we really needed to confront. 500,000 people have the opportunity to be exposed to it, you know, out live in the open.
And you also, my understanding is you learned some pretty stunning information from the Department of Homeland Security about human trafficking in Grand Rapids during Art Prize.
Yeah, well, and anytime you have a big event, the chances are it's going to go up, right? And there's speculation about that, like how much those numbers are. I mean, the Department of Homeland Security told me it goes up 400%. And, you know, how is that possible? Like, how do you even track that? But that was their statistic. So, you know, we know it goes up during the Super Bowl. We know it goes up other times. And we have to combat it then, but we have to combat it constantly because human trafficking has gone underground. It's gone onto the dark web. It's gone onto places where you can no longer see it. And so you have to find ways to recognize it in a new way and create legislation that can actually change it.
Now, you've structured this 90-minute play as a pilgrimage to tell six stories. Tell us more about the structure in these stories.
Well, one of the reasons we chose to do a pilgrimage is because we looked at old maps of the city of Grand Rapids where trafficking had historically taken place, and we thought, oh, this would be interesting to perform it in the city, you know, close to or on these sites where there were trafficking spots before, brothels, streetwalker areas, and so on. So we chose to perform it in the city for that reason. Then we were working together on trying to find a way to perform it in a way that would promote healing. And the idea there was a pilgrimage because, you know, people go on pilgrimages in order to find resilience and healing and restoration. And we wanted to have that for our city, for our region, and for the world. So we thought, let's do it as a pilgrimage. So it opens with a ritual of song and an unfolding of a cloth at every site. And then they move from site to site. So there's beautiful composed music that the women chorally sing, and then each woman tells us a different story.
Very, very moving, I'm sure. Give me an idea of the significance of the color blue, as in Stories in Blue. And I'm taking, is it a blue cloth that's unfolded?
Yeah, it's a blue cloth, huge blue cloth that's unfolded, and they use it to create sort of the texture of each piece. Blue is the color of anti-trafficking agencies worldwide. But, you know, when I got the title, it came from one of the interviewees. And what she told me is she's like, yeah, I mean, this is the color of liberation, but it is also the darkness of the oppressors. It's also the bondage of being held. It's the color of, so she said it has like all this meaning. So that's where I got the title from, is the depth of meaning in relationship to these stories.
And besides the play moving through these six locations in Grand Rapids every evening during Art Prize, you're also going to have a permanent video and photographic installation on the north side of the Art Prize area. Tell us about
that. Yeah, so we're way up on the edge of the north side of Art Prize at Crossroads Bible Church, which has an Art Prize theme of social justice, I guess you could say. We actually like this venue because historically, trafficking was pushed out to the edges a lot, you know, like way on the edges of cities. And this was one of those places. And what we're doing is this beautiful installation that has what's called cyanotype photography, blue photography. It's an old kind of photography, but we're printing it on fabric. So there's a textile photographic and then a really interesting film of the performances themselves that plays in the space. So there's music and film and texture and light and photography that try to, and then there's a lot of educational materials there too that talk about trafficking and the reason we did this piece and so on.
What kinds of actions are you hoping Stories in Blue will inspire as people see it and kind of let it soak in? What do you hope will happen from that?
We know that the Polaris Project, which is, you know, this hotline you can call that to report trafficking. We want people to know about that. We want people to know how to recognize it and how to fight against it. That's the first step. The second step is to promote legislation that will change it. So like Senator Judy Emmons is speaking at one of our performances on the 27th. She's the Michigan senator who's been working on anti-trafficking. And then Becky McDonald from Women at Risk is speaking this coming Saturday in the afternoon. And so, you know, we're trying to bring in people who are really working on the legislative side of things, because that's one of the things that needs to happen. We need to prosecute differently. We need to handle the prosecution differently. And so we're working on a way to make sure that that can happen. But, you know, there's not enough education and there's not enough fight against this issue right now. So that's where we're at. You know, some cities have come up with different models of prosecution. Like in Chicago, they're practicing the Nordic model that's practiced in Sweden, where they arrest johns and pimps rather than going after the women who are trafficked. And that has proven in Sweden and Norway to be a very, very positive model. And there are lots of different models out there for this, mm-hmm. but we're not really testing enough of them out and trying to see how we can stop this.
Using the power of theater to fight back against human trafficking. It's Stories in Blue, a pilgrimage to heal human trafficking. It'll run every evening of Art Prize 2016, except for Monday evenings, starting at 6:30 in front of the Van Andel Arena. You can get all the information by going to storiesinblue.com. Stephanie Sandberg, playwright and artistic director of Adapt Theater Company of Grand Rapids. Always great talking to you, finding out what Adapt is up to. Thank you so very much, Stephanie.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
The rise in police-related shootings of unarmed black people, the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, the rise in ambush-style attacks on police officers. These factors have many law enforcement agencies taking a new look at the way they protect and serve their communities. That's certainly the case with the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office, where Sheriff Jerry Clayton is implementing fundamental changes in staff training and community outreach. Sheriff Jerry Clayton is here with us today. Welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
How long have you been a law enforcement officer?
I'm in my 28th year in the profession, in my 8th year as sheriff.
And what brought you into the field in the first place?
It's interesting. I was originally a communications major. I got to the sheriff's office because I was a part-time job while I was playing football at Eastern Michigan University. And
no
I never
kidding.
Thought I'd stay.
So you didn't go in going, I want to be
Not
in
really.
Law enforcement.
No.
What drew you in? What made you decide this was going to be your life's calling?
So once you got going, you start to see the impact you can make on people. I started off working in corrections in the jail and started off at a time where you really didn't see, you know, people call them turnkeys and jailers. Mm-hmm. You didn't really see the purpose. But once you start interacting and you there's an operational philosophy of helping to manage the population and position them for success when they reenter, you actually start to see you can have an impact. And that's just been when I went to Road Patrol and everything else, it's just progressed.
So in a nearly three-decade career with that context, what has it been like for you personally seeing this steady procession of the kinds of stories that I just referenced, the police-related shootings that are on video and the ambush killings of law enforcement officers? We've seen officers killed in Dallas and Baton Rouge, the two bailiffs who were right. shot and killed in Berrien County. How has that hit you personally?
It reminds of a couple of things that, you know, obviously we're here to provide a service. So we should always be mindful of that. And that the criminal justice profession, corrections, police, dispatch, it's a noble profession. You're actually trying to serve. But let's not forget, it's dangerous. And that danger, not only to the police officers, but the trauma and the violence that sometimes you see, that affects you. And you have to have outlets. You have to have positive, constructive outlets. You have to have leadership that's thoughtful and provides direction and support. All those things sort of always now, especially in the seat that I sit in now, go in my head. And you know, as an African-American male, I get this question all the time. Well, you're an African-American, you're in this profession. Mm-hmm. I've been called everything from, you know, the younger, you know, a sellout to actually someone that people look to try to lead an evolution or a change in the profession that is beneficial to all. So, and I try to embrace that.
Have you noticed, especially as the torrent of news coverage of these kinds of stories, do you feel like your department has somehow lost some of the trust that you want the community to have in your department?
You know, that's such a great question. So we have spent 8 years since I've been in office trying to do a couple of things. So to be community leaders mm-hmm. and to recognize leadership means understanding the value that you add and understand the influence that you can have in the community. So the sheriff's office is a constitutionally elected office. So we respond directly to the people. So there's some impact that you can have there. And the other part is to understand that this is about partnership. So we can't police ourselves to a better community, and we can't solve all community problems by ourselves. So we need to know a couple things, that you do it in conjunction with partnership. That's mm-hmm. the community. That's with business leaders. That's with other elected officials. And you need to have a comprehensive strategy and solution to the problem. It's not just about arresting folks. Look, we've been doing that for how many years?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. We have to change that.
When you see the nightly news and there's some cell phone video out of Chicago or other city area, is that splashed back? Does your team feel that when they're out in the community and people maybe look at them differently because of what's happening elsewhere?
Sure. So as I said before, so for 8 years, we've been investing.
Yeah.
Community engagement, working with the community in positive ways. There are times that the sheriff's office is involved in a community activity, has nothing to do with policing.
Mm.
Absolutely nothing.
Just being a member of the community.
Just being a member of the community. Trying to be open, admit when you make mistakes, sort of challenge the community to also come to solutions. Mm-hmm. So what we hope we've done in 8 years is built up some credit in the bank, some credibility. So first off, people trust us, so maybe those events are less likely to happen. And we are in an unpredictable profession. So if something like this does happen, mm-hmm. Do we have enough credibility in the community where people will just pause and give us a chance to work with them towards some kind of positive outcome?
I'm impressed with the 6 professional development training sessions that you're introducing. This is for the staff: procedural justice, understanding implicit bias, verbal de-escalation, managing mental health crises, achieving cultural competence. What would you say is the unifying theme of these? And these are mandatory, right? Everybody
yes.
in the department's going
yes.
to these sessions.
Yes.
What's the unifying theme? What are you looking to accomplish?
So our belief is we should all agree on what the outcome should be when we have interactions with people.
Mm.
So our belief is, so those weren't just chosen at random. So you hear all the talking heads talking about de-escalation and all that. Those were chosen based on this. What are the outcomes we look for when we have contact, right? What behaviors should our staff and decisions should they make to try to get to those outcomes? Mm-hmm. And then what are knowledge and skills that they need to behave a certain way? Once we identified all that, then we said, okay, what kind of training do they need to get those knowledge and skills? So it's really a byproduct of a real thoughtful process and deliberate process. So we could have easily just done some training and checked the box. But I don't know if we would have equipped our staff with the tools necessary to have good outcomes. And that's what that is. So I could explain, I won't take you through everyone, but for each one of those subject matters, we can talk about specifically what kind of knowledge and skills we're trying to impact and what kind of outcomes we're looking for.
And it strikes me that these sessions could be seen as a good booster shot, especially for veteran officers, because as you say, you see things, it can kind of turn how you feel. My father was a firefighter. I know that stuff that you see that other people don't ever
That's
get
right.
exposed to, it can work in you and change you.
That's right.
So this is a booster shot in a sense, kind of getting everybody kind of recharged and refocused.
Sure, and on the same page, and we at least mm-hmm. we fancy ourselves as being a learning organization. So even if you've been on the job 20 years, there's still things you can learn. We've added, it's not in here, but we've also added Blue Courage, which is, now that's more about self-care,
mm-hmm.
nor about going back to, let's get away from the cynicism and remind ourselves of the nobility of the profession and why we're doing what we're doing. And the other thing I want to add is we've been working in conjunction with our community mental health and Dr. Deb Pynals, who is working for the state and University of Michigan. And we have developed a 2-day managing mental health crisis class that all deputy sheriffs dispatchers, correction officers will go through. And we're also going to put on, eventually, we hope sometime next year, the 40-hour crisis intervention team, the CIT that you've probably heard about, specialty training. Now, so that's another piece.
And then a big piece is following two town halls at Eastern Michigan University, you're stepping up efforts to talk with the community, the people you serve and protect. Tell us more about the community educational meetings you'll be holding.
Yeah, so it's, again, part of a longer-term strategy. So we've done what we call impact workshops. And if people go to beyondthebadge.tv, there's an episode that captures that talks about impact. So I'll leave it at there. We've done Just Calls, which are more intimate one-on-ones or three-on-threes with our deputies and community members. Then we did the town halls, which was really around people were really talking, expressing their emotional frustration and questions. It didn't really create some space for us to give very specific answers to some of the questions that they had. But we know in the absence of facts, myths emerge. So these forums, these sessions are really around, let's fill in some of the gaps. It's more educational, so it's really us delivering the information to folks. So it's not going to be a lot of questions to be asked, but these are being delivered in response to questions that we have heard now for the last couple of years that we know we need to provide answers for.
So, yeah, you're opening that up to the public. So there's recruitment, hiring, and promotion, new employee training, and then the session two, September 28th, Ypsilanti Township Hall. Evolution of subject control, use of force. I've got a lot of questions there, accountability practices.
Right.
And then session three will be October 12th at Dexter Middle School, veteran employee training. You're going to tell people about these new employee training series and corrections operations. So you're hoping you get as many members of the public to come in and learn.
I hope so.
Yeah.
People have been asking the questions forever. So we said, well, let's create the forum for them to come and receive that information. And the other piece, so once we've done that, we don't know how many times we'll end up doing it. Mm-hmm. Now that we have provided some information, the plan after that is to do some focus groups. So we're going to reach out and get a cross-section of people in the community and conduct some focus groups to start to glean from them, all right, if you had your way, what would police services look like in your community? Hmm. How would you behave? What are your expectations? What are some of your ideas now that you've gone through some of our sessions and you see what we do? Do you have any ideas to really now get that community input? And maybe we get some ideas. There's some trends that causes us to change a policy.
Make a course adjustment.
Right. So we're hopeful that this becomes a model that's replicated elsewhere.
And so ultimately, these efforts with the training sessions for employees, the reaching out to the community, answering their questions and talking with them, what do you hope will be the payoff for your deputies, so law enforcement officers in Washtenaw County and the people of Washtenaw County?
We're safer. Improved quality of life. A stronger relationship. A focus on solutions as opposed to blame. That's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping that that we see each other in a slightly different light as human beings that understand we have to work together toward a common goal for us to experience the kind of quality of life we all want.
The educational series is free. It's open to the public. You can call the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office and get all the information on registering. Washtenaw County Sheriff Jerry Clayton, thank you so much for sharing your efforts with us and talking with us on Stateside.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio.